Let's read again in the this time in the New Testament, in the Gospel according to John and chapter 1. We're continuing our series in this Gospel, and this morning looking at verse 14, John chapter 1, verse 14. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. If you were given a choice of where you would most like to live in this world, what would be, say, your top two choices? God had a choice as to the places he would most like to live in this world. And his top two choices are revealed to us, and we wish to study them today. And they are the most surprising of choices. His first choice in time, though his second choice in his preferences, was a tent. A tent. The tabernacle, as we'll see. His first choice in terms of priority, though second in time, was a human body and soul, human nature in the incarnation. And that's what the Apostle John brings before us here in this verse. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And that word dwelt is highly significant. It's the most important word in this verse, really. And it's literally tented or tabernacled or lived in a tent. And clearly, the Apostle is looking back at the Old Testament tabernacle and comparing what God did in dwelling there with what God is doing in dwelling in Christ, in a human nature. He's really comparing, you might say, two tabernacles, two tents. In the one case, the Old Testament one was made of wood and skins, animal skins and fabric. And the New Testament tent was made of flesh and blood and bones. And John is clearly saying, as the Apostle Paul does in the Epistle to the Hebrews, that this Old Testament tabernacle, this Old Testament tent, this Old Testament dwelling place for God is a type or a picture of a far greater tent, a far greater tabernacle, a far greater dwelling place of God, here described as the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. So we want to look at these two tents, these two tabernacles today. We want to compare them and see similarities on the one hand, but also contrasts on the other. Because as we'll see, the second tabernacle, the flesh and blood and bones tabernacle, is superior to the metal, wood, and skins tabernacle. You'll remember we've been going through this first chapter and noticing the Word, which is so up front in verse 1. We notice this Word was eternal, this Word was divine, this Word was God's communication towards us. And then as we've gone through this chapter, two words have kept appearing, light and life. The eternal Word, the divine message brings light and life to those who are in darkness and who are dying. And really this verse explains how that comes to be. How does the eternal and divine Word bring light and life into this world and into our lives? And here John's answer is, It was by that same Word becoming flesh and dwelling among us. So I want to, first of all today, compare the materials of these two tabernacles. First of all, think of that Old Testament tabernacle. You can read many, many chapters in Exodus on the kinds of materials. We read some of them today, but there are many other chapters full of all different kinds of materials, different kinds of wood, different kinds of skin, different kinds of fabric, different kinds of metal, different kinds of precious stones. But I think what's emphasized really is how temporary this tabernacle was. It was a tent. There's not much more temporary than a tent, is there? Nobody lives in a tent permanently. You live in a tent as a make-do or for a short vacation, but you don't live in a tent as a permanent residence. And that was one of the emphases of this whole structure, that it was temporary. It wasn't to last. It was never to be a permanent residence for God. And another thing about this is how unattractive it was, at least on the outside. Now, as you read, there were some beautiful things about this tabernacle, but they were all inside. You couldn't see it from the outside. If you looked at this from the outside, you would see a pretty ugly structure, really. It was very functional on the outside. Most of what was visible were animal skins that were particularly waterproof. And that was really the primary function. It was to be practical. It was to be a structure that the outside protected. And so people would look at this tabernacle and, well, maybe they wouldn't give it a second look. It wasn't particularly big. It was about 45 feet long. It was about 15 feet wide. It was about 8 feet high. So it just wasn't much to look at, pretty unattractive, and therefore it was really quite a humbling place to live. It was a very humbling choice of God to choose to live in a place like that, in a tent that was generally unattractive, at least to the outside observer. And this was very different to the structures of the big and important cultures of that day. I mean, the Egyptians, of course, had their glorious pyramids. The Babylonians had their amazing ziggurats. And Israel has a kind of ugly tent. And as we'll see, there's a message in this as well, expressing, even at this early stage, God's willingness to be humbled, or to experience humbling in order to meet with and dwell with people like us. So that's the Old Testament materials. What do we find, though, in the New Testament tabernacle? Here we read, the Word was made flesh. The Word, again referring back to the Son of God, fully divine, equal in power and glory to the Father and the Spirit, this Word was made flesh. Here's the materials of this New Testament tabernacle. Flesh, just like this. Skin and bones and blood and muscle and sinew. The Word became flesh. He, as somebody put it, he became what he was not. He became what he was not. He became a man. He wasn't a man before. He became what he was not while remaining what he was before. God. So in becoming a man, he did not cease to be God. He's God and man. Here are the materials of this tabernacle. There's deity for sure, but there's humanity. Full humanity, normal humanity, like our humanity in every single respect apart from lacking our sinfulness, which of course is no lack at all. He had a whole human nature with all human senses, all human faculties, all human parts. It's really a remarkable statement in a few words. The Word became flesh. The Word became man. And hundreds, thousands of years have been spent now trying to understand what this means. And at the end of the day, we keep coming back to Paul's words to Timothy. Great is the mystery of godliness. God was manifest in the flesh. God became visible in humanity. I think it was Matthew Henry who said, reason is never more reasonable than when it ceases to reason about what is above reason. And in many ways, that's where we're brought to by the mystery of the incarnation. We'll never fully figure this out, but we believe both fully God and fully man. These were the materials. And here's a contrast with the tabernacle. Remember, the tabernacle was temporary. This tabernacle is permanent. That the Old Testament wood and fabric and stones, they've all gone. They've all disintegrated, probably just dust in the desert, much of it now. But this New Testament tabernacle, this fleshness, is permanent. The Son of God didn't become flesh and then stop becoming flesh. He didn't inhabit manhood and then leave it behind. No. When he joined himself to this human nature, it became a permanent part of his being, of his person. He's united to it forever. It's with him to this day. That's just amazing. You know, there are some mythologies, Greek, Roman mythologies, about the so-called gods, small g, these idols that these ancient cultures used to worship. And some of the myths describe times when these so-called gods came down to earth and spent some time with men. But there are two huge differences between their coming and dwelling and this coming and dwelling. Number one, they never became men. They remained so-called gods. They never humbled themselves that far. And secondly, they always left after a short time. Once things got a bit messy or difficult for them in their myth, then they left behind this experience of being amongst men. This tabernacle does not do that. Christ became a real man and is a real man both now and forever. Another way we can compare this is, remember we said this Old Testament tabernacle was rather unattractive on the outside. That's one of the emphases about the New Testament tabernacle too. And in fact, this was prophesied, you'll remember, by Isaiah the prophet, that when the Messiah would come, they were told at the beginning of Isaiah chapter 53 what he would look like. And we're told, he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, as a root out of a dry ground. He has no form nor comeliness. And when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Just as the Old Testament tabernacle, people looked at it and thought, nothing to see. People looked at the New Testament tabernacle and said, nothing to see. They looked at Christ, they saw no glory, they saw no beauty. There was nothing specially attractive about him. In fact, at one point, as again Isaiah prophesied, his face was so marred that he didn't even look like a man. He was so disfigured by his sufferings. This is why the hymn writer spoke in these terms, veiled in flesh. The Godhead, see, the flesh, as it were, it was a covering, a veil That so that when people just looked on the outside, if they just used their normal eyes, there was nothing attractive or compelling in what they saw. And again, this was humbling. If the Old Testament tabernacle portrayed God's desire to experience a humbling, to be amongst sinners, then how much more the New Testament tabernacle? You think of Philippians 2, how it speaks of Christ being in the form of God, who yet became a servant, who became obedient even unto the death of the cross. But you know, even without that suffering, even without becoming a servant, even without coming under the law, even without dying on the cross, just becoming a man was humiliation. For the Word to become flesh, even in a perfect world, was humbling. And you ask yourself, why did God choose these two places to live in, this tent and this tent, this metal and skin and wood, this flesh and blood and bone? Why is it not expressing his amazing willingness and indeed his desire to dwell among us, to meet with us, to commune with us, and to make all that possible? The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Compare the materials. Secondly, compare the dwelling, compare the presence. Remember we read in Exodus 25 about why God dictated this structure. It was so that He could meet, so that He could dwell, so that He could be a presence with His people. And it's interesting, if you look back on the history after sin came into the world, how was God going to meet with sinners? Well, what He did was He met in a few places here and there where people erected altars to sacrifice. So you read that with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob in Genesis, how they would regularly erect some stones, make some sacrifices, and there God would meet with them. So He was meeting in a few places geographically with a few people here and there. And then when Israel became a nation, He decided to change the way He would meet with people by centralizing everything in one place, the tabernacle. No longer were men allowed to build here, build there, wherever they liked. No, everything had to be done in one place to keep the nation together, to keep the nation as pure as possible in their worship. And so He dictated just one place on earth where He promised to dwell and be with and meet with His people. And that itself was grace, that He would meet anywhere. But when we compare the New Testament tabernacle, what do we find? We find by God dwelling in human flesh, He could dwell amongst the general population. No longer just a few places, wherever stones were. No longer just in one place. But as Jesus moved around that whole region, He, God, was dwelling with and meeting with and present with all kinds of people in all kinds of places and all kinds of situations. This is why He was called Emmanuel, God with us. Us, not just Israel now, but us in general. All people had now access to this God. He dwelt among the general population in the body of His Son. Again, you notice the old is good, the new is better. The new has some grace, as we'll see. Sorry, the old has some grace, the new is full of grace. There's some dwelling and some meeting and some presence in the old, but there's so much greater meeting and dwelling and presence in the new. But then thirdly, we can compare the glories, because it says the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. We beheld His glory. Again, think of the old tent. The tent in Hebrew is Mishkan. That's the Hebrew word, Mishkan. And there's a word that's used very similar to that to describe God's presence. It's called the Shekinah. Do you hear the similarity? Mishkan tent, Shekinah, God's presence, God's glory. That was the bright shining cloud that God manifested Himself to His people in and through. And when the tabernacle was built and erected, you can read about this in Exodus 40, this bright cloud, this Shekinah, this dwelling place of God, came, it lowered itself, it went into the tabernacle, and especially dwelt in the most holy place. Because this tent had sort of three sections. There was the tabernacle in general, there was a holy place, and then there was a most holy place. And there, this cloud, this glory cloud, this shining of God was present. But if you think about that, who saw it? Who saw that? Well, of course, they would see the cloud as it came in. I should say as He came in. But once the cloud was inside, who could see it? Not many. At times, the cloud would rise up and sort of lead them and guide them to move in the desert. But a lot of the time, that cloud could not be seen. It was within layers of skins and fabrics. The high priest, once a year, would go into the most holy place with blood to sprinkle on the mercy seat, and there would be the cloud of glory. So one person, once a year, would see that cloud, apart from the times when they moved, and the cloud would go far away and far ahead and lead them to another place. So, in some senses, you could say some people at some times saw His glory. That's the max in the Old Testament. That's why, remember, Moses prayed to the Lord, "Show me Your glory." And the Lord said, "No man can see My face and live." It wasn't time, it wasn't opportunity. There still had to be veils and curtains and barriers. But when we come to the new, what do we read? We. Notice the plural, we. And it's not just the high priest. We. It's all people with faith. We beheld His glory. We beheld His glory. One of the amazing results of this New Testament tabernacle was a lot more people could see the glory of God. We. This is a big word for John, glory. It appears 18 times in his gospel. Glorify appears 23 times. So John's really focused on glory. You could say he's almost obsessed with the glory of Christ, which is a glorious obsession. But it's an unusual glory that he's fixated on. When we think of glory, we are thinking of the glory of big numbers and maybe big popularity and maybe big dollars and big properties and big successes. That's worldly glory. That's not the kind of glory that the Apostle John speaks of, because Christ lived in obscurity, generally speaking, apart from one or two times there were little blips of popularity, but on the whole, He lived in obscurity. He lived in an obscure place. He was followed by obscure people, one of whom betrayed Him, another disowned Him, and ultimately died the most cursed, shameful, embarrassing death that anyone could die in these days. So where's the glory? What's John talking about when he says we beheld his glory? Well, the glory he's speaking of is the glory of humble service. The glory of humble. That for John is ultimate glory. And it's a strange glory. And that's why Jesus, just shortly before his death, said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified." And he's speaking of the cross that's about to happen. The glory of the greatest humbling, the greatest service that anyone could ever offer. That's what John's speaking of when he says, "We beheld his glory." Here is the Word, the eternal Son of God, who's become flesh. Not just that, he humbles himself to serve. He humbles himself even further to suffer. And he humbles himself even further to die. You couldn't get lower. We're scraping the ground here. And John looks at that and says, glory. We are seeing glory as we've never seen it before. In the Old Testament, you cannot see my face and live, when Moses asked to see the glory. The answer to the New Testament question, show me your glory, is look at the cross. That's how we can see God's face and live. It gives life. Doesn't kill us. Doesn't destroy us. It's astounding, isn't it? As the apostle puts it in 2 Corinthians 4, we see the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. In the face. You look at that cross. You look at that visage. That countenance. That expression that is so twisted. So macerated. So lacerated. So deformed by agonies and pains. Human and divine. And John says, look at that. That is the greatest glory the world has ever seen. It reveals more of God than anything else in this world. Think of that as we head towards next weekend. We're beholding glory. We're beholding glory. It's also interesting that the word here for beheld, it's not the word of just a look or a glance, something cursory and brief. It's the word for gaze upon at length. Such a gaze, such a study, such an analysis that eventually leads to understanding. That's the kind of seeing that he's speaking of here. He's calling us to look on this face, this person, this tabernacle in a way that we don't look at anyone else. He's saying stare. It's not rude to stare in this circumstance. He's saying stare. Don't take your eyes off this person, this tabernacle, this dwelling place of God. Don't take your eyes off that suffering servant until you see glory. The glory of his deity, the glory of his identity, the glory of his character, the glory of his humiliation, the glory of his salvation, so that you can join yourself to this marvelous statement, we, me too, we beheld his glory. And we don't need to have seen that with physical eyes, his physical body. We can still see his glory by faith as Christ crucified is set forth among us through the preaching of the word, through the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, through the symbols of that broken body and shed blood. Still by faith, through that word and through these symbols, we see the glory of God. And once you see that, you don't stop seeing it. You don't stop staring, surely. This isn't something we do once and then look away. This is a beholding, a staring, an analyzing, that never ends, that never stops. Compare the glories. Then compare the truths, because notice, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. We beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten, the only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. We'll deal with grace in a minute. But first of all, full of truth. The Old Testament tabernacle had truth. It had some truth. That it was, you might say it was like Israel's catechism class. It was like their Sunday school. It was designed in such a way that even children could get it. He designed the structure of it, the layout of it, the rooms of it, the furniture of it, the liturgy and the rituals of it, so that truth was being communicated through these physical symbols. Even just the way the place was structured. So you have the tabernacle as a whole, the outer border of it, which every Israelite could enter. And then you had a holy place, which only priests could go into, and had on one side the candlestick, on the other side loaves of bread, and in front of you there was an altar of incense that beautiful fragrance rose from. In that place only the priests could go. And then you had another room off that called the most holy place. And there only the high priest, and only once a year could he go in there, and not without blood of sacrifice. So even the structure is saying God is holy, and as you get nearer to the place that He dwells, greater and greater care and reverence and fear and trembling is required. Even a child could understand that just by looking. Even the materials of the tabernacle, the outside of it had the cheapest materials, the most ugly materials, you might say. But as you got closer, the fabric, the wood, and the metal became more and more precious, more and more valuable. It sort of went from bronze to silver to gold. It went from outer skins of horrible animals to the inner curtains, which are beautifully woven with cherubim and seraphim. And again, this was communicating to even this simplest child the truth of God's holiness. As you get nearer, you're getting nearer to something oh so much more valuable and precious and beautiful too. God is beautiful was also being taught through this. But God is Savior was also being taught, because what was the first thing you saw as you walked in the door of this tent? Right there in front of you was a huge big bronze altar upon which sacrifices were continually being offered. You couldn't get past that. You couldn't almost get past the door without a sacrifice. It's saying, yes, you can draw near to God, and yes, God can draw near to you. Yes, you can meet with Him here, but only through sacrifice, only through the shedding of blood, only through the mediation of a priest. Again, that was everyday ritual. Every day this could be seen and learned. There's truth there. We could go on, or many truths there. You think of the candlestick on the one hand, light, God is light. You think of the loaves on the other, indicating God's provision for Israel. God gives life. Remember? John's emphasis, light and life. He's leading up to this. He's God's tabernacle. But however much truth we find in the old tabernacle, in the flesh and in the wood and metal tabernacle, the flesh and blood tabernacle has more. This is why John says, full, overflowing and abounding with truth. If the Old Testament tabernacle taught us that God was holy, how much more did the new? When you see Him suffering on the cross, stretched out, suffering the wrath of God, what does it tell you but that God is so holy that He will punish sin even when He finds it on His Son? Not His own, of course, but reckoned to him. But above all, we find the fullness of salvation, don't we? That same place and that same tabernacle that tells us God is holy also tells us God is Savior. God is Savior. Sinners can approach this holy God through this sacrifice, through this priest, through this mediator, through this offering of himself once for all. Full of truth. How could God have found a better way to pack more truth into one small place as the person of his Son? We're still unpacking it, aren't we? That's why we gather here. That's why we read our Bibles. We're trying to unpack the Word. We're trying to get more truth out of the Word made flesh and dwelling among us. Full of truth. If you need truth in your life, and who doesn't? In a world so full of lies, with a heart so full of lies, with the Father of lies continually bombarding us with his propaganda, here is where we go, to the fullness of truth. So much so he could say, I am the truth. The Old Testament had truth. That tabernacle did have truth. But it was like shadows compared to the noonday sun. It was a picture of massive reality. A limited picture of unlimited truth. I'm sure many of us have seen photographs of the new World Trade Center, One World Center as it's called, One World Trade Center. You remember seeing the models as that was being devised and designed and built, and now we can see film, we can see photographs. Well, on Friday I was flying into New Jersey and I saw it in reality, and it's just staggering. It's really just, it's awesome. Nothing can really, however much you learn from the models, the pictures and the films, the actual sight was really overwhelming. And this is what John is saying too. These were models, these of truth, but here's fullness of truth. Full sacrifice. Full truth about sacrifice. The full truth about mediation. The full truth about priesthood. The full truth about prayer and worship. The full truth about grace. And that's what we come to now, lastly. Compare the graces. Again, there was grace in the Old Testament tabernacle. There was much grace. I hope you've seen that. The grace of God dwelling in that place. The grace of God allowing people to approach him through sacrifice. The grace of all that he taught the Old Testament people through that structure. There was grace, but it was still limited grace. It was also problematic in that because it was so physical, there's something in the human heart that sort of attaches itself to the physical and doesn't get to the spiritual behind it. And that happened to Israel a lot. They just thought, well, we go to the tabernacle, we'll do the sacrifices, and we'll be safe. But they didn't seek the salvation behind the symbols that the symbols were presenting. And so they often turned pictures of grace into law and legalism. What was intended for their salvation, they twisted it to their damnation. It's one of the flaws, as it were, of human nature. That you could take something so full of grace and turn it into something so full of law and damnation. But however much grace was there, how much more is here? Full of grace. And it's interesting, the word grace originally meant beauty or charm. And what it's saying is, if we look to Christ, we see the fullness of beauty. We see someone who is just superlatively charming and attractive and compelling, especially when we see what John saw. the word developed so that it eventually became, had the meaning of someone dealing with you in the opposite way to what you deserved or expected. And that's more, much more than somebody not dealing with you as you deserved. That would be grace, but it's not the fullness of grace. Somebody not treating you as you deserved. This is more. This is someone treating you in the opposite way to what you deserved. In other words, if you owed $1 million and you deserved $1 million worth of punishment for not paying that debt, it's like someone comes and says, have $1 million. This is really the essence of grace. It's God dealing with us in the opposite way that we deserved, and He can only do that through Christ. He can not only take away our sin so that He does not deal with us as we deserve, but He also imputes, He credits a righteousness, an obedience, and a perfection so that He can deal with us in the opposite way to we deserve. In other words, He can deal with us as He treats His Son, with similar love and affection and acceptance and sonship. That's why He says, full of grace, dazzling, astonishing, beautiful. What could be more beautiful and charming than this kind of grace? Who here does not need that? Who can deny this is the greatest need of our lives? And John here is pointing us towards this flesh and blood tabernacle, and he's saying, you need grace? There is grace in all its fullness. Grace overflowing. So that no matter how much grace you take out, there's more to come. It's, as it were, an overflowing fountain. It's not like there's a limit. So that if every single soul in the whole world came to Christ and took all the grace they needed, he'd be depleted. He'd need time to recover and refuel and fill up grace levels. No. He's always full. He's always overflowing. You cannot exhaust. You cannot deplete this grace. He'll never run out of it. He'll never have too little of it. He has sufficient grace for every soul that comes to Him for it. Here is a true tabernacle. The ultimate tabernacle. The perfect tabernacle. Compare and contrast. Yes, learn from the old, but learn more from the new. And seek out this truth and grace that you so much need for your life, so that you can sing, as we sang earlier, how beautiful are the tabernacles of your grace. Amen.